Hey everyone, I'm Julie Gunlock, your host of the Bespoke Parenting Podcast. For those new to the program, this podcast is focused on how parents should custom tailor their parenting style to fit what's best for their families, themselves, and most importantly, their kids. We all know that there is a mental health crisis plaguing children today. Data backs this up. The CDC's National Center for Health Statistics recently released data showing that 15% of America's children aged 5 to 17 are getting treatment for mental health conditions. Adolescents showed the worst numbers in this data brief, with nearly 19% of children age 12 to 17 receiving treatment, including therapy, counseling, or prescription medication. These numbers confirm, again, what we all know: kids are not doing okay. And we know it comes from a cocktail of sources, including COVID-19, school shutdowns, extended masking, and of course, social media, and some of the destructive social trends that are present today. Joining me to discuss this and explain what this all means is Dr. Chloe Carmichael, a clinical psychologist and best-selling author. She is a leading expert on anxiety and stress management and is the author of the book Nervous Energy: Harness the Power of Your Anxiety, which I love that concept. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Julie. It's great to be with you and the Independent Women's Forum community. I'm such a fan of everything that you all are doing.
Well, thank you so much. And we need voices like yours that are in the medical profession to help parents, because parents have so many questions. And sadly, I think today parents are really skeptical of the medical profession. They don't necessarily trust, particularly psychiatrists, who in many cases, in fairness, have betrayed many parents. Mm-hmm. So I want to get into that. But I first want to just touch on your book. I love that title. I feel like I always have nervous energy. So it definitely speaks to me. But is this nervous energy, or is this much more of like a significant mental health crisis among young people?
Yeah, you know, Julie, that is such a good question. And I love the way that you framed this conversation from the start by saying that, of course, with good reason, parents today, including myself, have zero trust in what comes out of, you know, the factory of psychology, psychiatry. And so I think it's more than fair to be extremely skeptical when we hear these statistics, you know, I don't know, whatever the latest is, a third of kids, you know, have a diagnosis or whatever, especially when we know that these are the same people that told us that we should be masking our children, which, by the way, was like my mama bear coming out of the closet moment when they wanted to mask my 3-year-old at the time. It was the first time, you know, for me as somebody that has a media presence and had always been very careful to never say anything that was untrue, but also never kind of wade into topics that I knew could turn the media off to me. That was when I said, I just don't care. And I, you know, went full force talking about, you know, which frankly should be obvious, you know, but that like masking children, to me, in my opinion, is really tantamount to child abuse, unless, you know, you have a really good reason for it. Yeah. And there was no really good reason. So again, it's the same folks that told us to mask our kids. It's the same folks that are telling us that boys can be girls, and that, you know, you're a bad parent if, you know, you try to tell your kid the truth about the fact that they were born a girl and that they'll stay a girl no matter how many cosmetic surgeries they may have or whatever they inject themselves with. So there's also this desire to medicalize and monetize every feeling, right? So if you have a kid that, you know, is anxious about a math test, oh, well, they have test anxiety. Oh, if they're anxious about, you know, making new friends, gee, maybe they have social phobia.
Right.
You know, and I, for one, as a clinical psychologist and as a mom, I'm really disgusted by it. So with that said, you know, to answer your question, like, you know, is this, you know, nervous energy, or is it something else? I think that there's two very fair perspectives, and the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. I do think that the mental health of kids today is being legitimately taxed, ironically, by the mental health industry, probably more than anything, telling them like, oh, geez, someone was mean to you.
Yes,
oh,
it's the power of suggestion. And I want to get into that because I think that that is a really powerful force. But it's very interesting what you just said. You said, you know, we have a diagnosis for everything. So you can't just be a normal kid who's acting normal in his nervousness about taking a test. No, you suddenly have to take test anxiety. And you know what they do with that? They will often take a kid and put them in a separate room and let them take the test. And it's wrapping them in cotton wool and saying like, oh, let's make this environment as nice as, I mean, he's going to have to carry that. What, in jobs? Are you going to be able to go to a private room and do a presentation? No.
And get extra time and everything else. Which creates, of course, the victim economy where, you know, the more disabled you are, the more, treats and rewards that you get. So the premise of my book, you know, where that fits in, you know, nervous energy, harness the power of your anxiety, is that there's a little known secret that it seems psychologists are trying to keep from people, which is that there is actually a healthy function to anxiety. And this isn't my personal insight. This is just a simple psychology fact. The healthy function to anxiety is to stimulate preparation behaviors. So if, you know, Junior is nervous about his math test, we say, well, you know what? Mother Nature gives us that extra zing of adrenaline. It brings energy. It actually does narrow our focus. The good news is that if we point that in the right direction, if we say, okay, well, I'm super nervous, I'm going to put that energy into making flashcards. I'm right. super nervous. I'm going to write out 10 questions that I think could be on the test and then see if I can solve them, right? So that's why it's called nervous energy, harness the power of your anxiety. It's supposed to help us to use the anxiety constructively instead of getting anxiety about anxiety.
That is so interesting. It's so fascinating to hear you say that because that actually has helped me over the years. I feel nervous about something, so I prepare more. And actually, it's funny. Sometimes I make myself walk away, go take a walk, and then I come back. And I really, I've sort of memorized the material, or I feel more comfortable with the material. But that it is that initial anxiety that really makes, and you can apply that to other things. You know, there's been all these books written about how, you know, women in particular should really pay attention to their instincts if they feel like they're in danger, right? And they should listen to that. It goes back. It's part of our, you know, the sort of animal in us warning us that, you know, there's danger near, and we really need to listen to that voice. And yet, especially with the trans issue now, you know, we're being told, no, ignore that voice. And in fact, if you're nervous about changing your clothes in a locker room next to a biological male, then you're the one who has a problem. And so
I was thinking exactly the same thing. Yes, exactly.
So women are constantly, and kids are being told to, it's interesting to me because I never even thought of it this way, that the anxiety that they're feeling, they're being trained to see that as something that's bad and that you need to actually lean into rather than overcome. And the other problem is, and I'd love to hear you, there's something about overcoming a fear. I used to be terrified of speaking in public, really to the point where I would get sick. I was so nervous. And today I always get a little bit of butterflies and I feel a little nervous, but I'm able to do it. And then afterwards, I always remember that scared person that I was. And I think, oh, you know, through different coping mechanisms and breathing and talking to people, I really did overcome that. And that is such a wonderful thing for me personally. And yet now kids aren't going to have that same kind of reward of overcoming their fears. Talk to me a little bit about how we've removed that, the sort of sense of accomplishment from kids.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we've also vilified even a desire for accomplishment, right?
Yes.
So like by, you know, vilifying a meritocracy, or by suggesting that an excitement for competition is toxic masculinity, right? So, you know, we've not only removed a lot of the traditional ways a person would have accomplishments by giving them, you know, accommodations, you know, as to why they should just get double the test time. You know, we've also kind of vilified the people who say, well, you know what, in fact, I just want to be number one. I want to win. Or what if you're a girl who wants to win, you know, the 100-yard dash, right? You know, I mean, right. Good luck if you, you know, have to be running against actually a man.
Right.
You know, but you also mentioned stress and, you know, the way that you experienced anxiety and a certain amount of stress, and then you overcame it and you grew from that. So the thing is also, this is related to the idea that there is a healthy function to anxiety, which is to stimulate preparation behaviors, when there's actually also a healthy function of stress. So anyone who's ever been to the gym and lifted weights, you know, when your muscles are literally just shaking because you're at your max, that is actually when you're getting your money's worth at the gym. That shaking means that you are stressing your muscles to their absolute max. And that is the time, you know, that they are going to grow. So when people are under stress now, again, it's like we automatically assume, who's doing this to you? Who's the bully? Who's putting this on you? You know, as opposed to even just helping them to say, well, you know, you're going through a tough time, you know, but you're gonna grow from this, and you don't have to be going through this alone. I think that's the thing too, is, you know, parents have been undermined in their duty and their pleasure of, you know, just being alongside their children through whatever life may bring. And that's being supplanted by, you know, this bizarre team of therapists and medication and, you know, school, I don't know, occupational therapists, all kinds of people. And again, I have nothing against, like, I literally am a clinical psychologist. So, and, you know, one of my best friends is an occupational therapist. And so I don't at all mean to talk about like every single one, or else I'd even be talking about myself, you know. But I just think that as a whole, there's this quote expert class that is interfering with parents' ability to even just come alongside their child during a difficult time. Like even if someone's being kind of mean to them at school, and to be able to say, you know, Junior, we don't like have necessarily a way to quote fix this for you, but I'm glad you're talking to me about it. You're not alone. We can go through this together, even if we don't have a solution. You know, we can come up with, you know, some things you can say back. We can talk about having an ally. We can talk about, you know, ways to maybe have the teacher keep an eye on it and put some boundaries around it. But no, we don't have a quote expectation that you're going to go through the school day and nobody's ever going to say anything mean to you. It's
right.
it's just not life. But the good news is you don't have to go through it alone, because I, as your parent, can be here and love you through this. We're losing that by saying, well, why don't you talk to your therapist about it? Or why don't we, you know, talk to the teacher or the principal? And there's a time and a place for all that. But I just think that the parent is getting somehow excluded.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I had, I'm not sure my children love it when I tell these stories about them, but when my child, I think he was in like first or second grade, and he had some stress because there were some pretty mean bullies in his class. So we'd been kind of dealing with it. And my sister, who is a social worker, gave him some cards for meditation and breathing exercises, so that when he was in the classroom, he could kind of utilize these coping skills of breathing and keeping his temper in place and trying to ignore them. And I thought it was a very nice gift. Well, part of it was also that they had little drawings, and they showed, you know, the people in the lotus position sitting cross-legged. And what my son did is he decided to do that position on the playground and do breathing exercises in a very, like, you know, a very ostentatious way. Okay. And he got bullied even worse. Right. And so he comes home and he tells me this. And I said, yeah, because I probably would have made fun of you too. Now, I said it tongue in cheek, and he laughed and I laughed. And I said, look, you know, don't do that, because they're going to make fun of you. Now, I could have, and I feel like this is kind of the trend now, I could have gone to the teacher and said, you know, he needs a safe space to do his, you know, meditation. And, or how could those kids do that? And, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm like, if I were a second grader and somebody plopped down in the middle of the playground, lotus position, and started meditating, I would probably laugh at them. Now, you could call me mean, Or you could say, this is probably the nature of children at that age, and try to advise your son not to do that. And
no, anyway, I'm right there with you. I have to say, like, it was actually last week with my son who's in first grade. Something similar happened where he was playing four square, went for a ball and ended up, you know, falling on his bottom, and, you know, the kids laughed, and he, you know, the poor thing, I love him to pieces. He got tearful and ran away, and he told me the story after school. And of course, you know, I hear the story with love and compassion and give him a hug, but I also say to him, you know what though? Haven't you laughed when someone fell on their bottom?
Yes.
What would it be like if next time that happened, you actually put up your hands and showed that you could laugh at yourself and then just get back in line to play again?
Yes.
And ironically, the same thing happened the next day. And he did it the new way, where he just laughed as he said, you know what, I did it again. And, right. and he had a much better time.
That's so great. And, you know, it's funny because that was my instinct to react that way to my son. And it was based a lot on how my mother would have reacted to me, right? She would have said, well, you know, if you're going to put yourself in a weird position, you're right. But she also would have been tender with me and kind and said, like, I know, but, and actually I did. I said, I'm really glad that you're using these breathing mechanisms and coping mechanisms. And I'm really glad that you're doing this, but let's maybe do it quietly in the class. Anyway, so we figured it out. But I feel like parents too, not only are children being told to ignore their instincts, I feel like parents are being told to ignore the quite natural things that come to them as a parent. Like, Jack was my first. I didn't know if I was doing the right thing, but I kind of just muddled through. And I really am now, as he's older, I'm older. I feel like, okay, I did the right thing. But parents are constantly being told to go the other direction, complain and expect safe spaces and all this. And it makes it really difficult.
Yeah. So, I mean, I totally agree. And the problem with this quote, expert class, you know, telling parents all these things is that the parents don't, you know, have the education, understandably, to necessarily be able to answer back and say, no, I'm sorry, that doesn't make sense. And they have nothing but their instincts. And I think that's a beautiful thing, is instincts, but parents should not allow themselves to be belittled for their instincts. Like, just another example is in kindergarten, my son was, you know, kind of constantly squirming around and all over the place on the story rug, more than he really even should have been, more than even, you know, for a kindergartner. And so, you know, this supposed expert was like, well, maybe he should be given an accommodation to lie on his stomach, you know? And I said, no, because all that's going to happen then is he's going to then push the boundary to, like, well, I need to roll on my stomach. So I told him a certain consequence that would happen every time that I ever heard about him causing this problem. And the problem never happened again, you know?
It's such a great point also, how you talk about how you partnered with the teacher. If she reports to me, then there's a consequence at home. And actually, some of the best behavioral modification tactics that I have tried with my three children is partnering very closely with the teacher to get reports so that I can back her up. I can, you know, sort of explain that we're on the same side here and you need to. So that is such a great example of how, and yet, sadly, I feel like sometimes in the schools, and not necessarily teachers, because I have really had really wonderful teachers, but I do feel like there's a culture of us against them in the schools.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, you and I, it sounds like, are fortunate enough, and my son does go to a private Christian school, and I'm very thankful for that. But I do have thoughts and ideas, you know, for parents that are, unfortunately, maybe they have a teacher who's, you know, drunk on his or her own, you know, fantasy that they are some sort of incredible child expert. And, you know, they want to actually undermine your own child's progress by, you know, constantly suggesting that this child needs medication or accommodations, you know, maybe because it makes the teacher's life easier if their kids are medicated into zombie land, or it makes the teacher feel really important if they're, you know, directing these quote treatments, you know, that they really have no place. But that's why I'm so glad. I hope I'm not, you know, I'm sorry if I'm spilling the beans, but I'm so glad that you're interviewing Abigail Schreier soon for Bad Therapy, because I have read the book and I think it's a great manual for any parent that wants to answer back to any of these supposed experts and say, as you said, Julie, like, actually, no, I'm the parent. And that's the best thing for the kid. The kid feels safest when they have clear boundaries. They know who's in charge. They know the foundation. And they know that every, limit that's being put on them is being put on them by someone who loves them to pieces. That makes the kid feel so much safer than feeling like, you know, some ward of the state, you know, just getting these directions that can change every 6 months.
I want to talk also about something else that's happening in schools, which is, we kind of touched on it earlier, this sort of, you're suggesting problems to kids. And that, I know you've talked a lot about SEL, where I think a lot of this comes from. For those who aren't familiar with SEL, let's go to the beginning. What is SEL? And what is it that you think it, why can it be problematic?
Yeah, so it sounds really good on the surface, just like a lot of these programs too, right? Like the Inflation Reduction Act, or, you know, Build Back Better Care, like, which is actually the opposite, right? It is the opposite of affirming, you know, your natural sexual
biology,
you know.
So
SEL, again, it sounds great. Social emotional learning, like, sounds great, right? But unfortunately, what it can be in some cases, and every SEL program is different, you know, there's a million different, you know, SEL curriculum and whatnot that schools can get. So I'm not trying to say about it all, but I have personally examined some of the SEL materials, and you just don't, given everything that we've said already here up to this point in the conversation, are these the people that you want in charge of, quote, programming your child in terms of what is socially normal? What is emotionally healthy? I mean, social emotional learning, who's the teacher there? It's the state, it's the government, right? Creating for your child what's normal socially and emotionally. And what I found most disturbing out of the materials that I personally examined, I examined some materials that were part of a daycare curriculum with, you know, very young children, like, you know, 2-3 years old. And they had what they called the I love you rituals. And that was literally the name of it. I love you rituals. And the, you know, they call it caregiver. I'm going to say daycare worker. You know, as they are, you know, changing your child's diaper or doing whatever else, ways that that person would be speaking and communicating love. And to me, I found it so grossly inappropriate. Like, you don't know that child, really. You don't have, the love is such a, it creates such a vulnerable, it signifies a deep level of trust. It signifies an enduring type of relationship. And especially from an adult to a child, it's, you know, such a laden term. And the idea that they were literally manualizing in the manual, the I love you rituals, I was just like, I would never want. Now, I will say, I'm not some kind of crazy, you know, like, my son's teacher tells him she loves him. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that because I know her and I trust her and it makes sense. But if it were some sort of weird manual where she's like, today's the day I'm going to,
I will now say I love you. It's very weird. It is weird. And I like the word manualize. That's such a great word to use, where increasingly now it's, and kids pick up on that. They can tell it's not genuine. You know, our kids' teacher too will be like, I just love you. You are so cute, to my son, right? In a way that's very sweet and endearing. And it, you know, it really means a lot to him to hear that kind of affection and stuff. But again, totally organic. The idea that, like, I love that word because it is false. It is fake. And kids, I firmly believe kids can sense that.
Well, it's one of two things. They either sense that it's fake, which obviously is really weird because then they're being asked to kind of parrot and pantomime something that isn't true, Or if the kids are like very young and very vulnerable,
and believe
and
it, you're
like
right.
sponges, then they can get a warped idea
Yes.
of what the word love even means, right? So that's just one example of, you know, why I would just say to any parent listening that if you have concerns about this, ask your child's, you know, school or wherever they would be exposed. Do you have an SEL program? If yes, I would like to see the materials. I would like to examine them. I just think that anyone who's literally saying, I'm going to be tinkering with your child's sense of social and emotional stability, I want to see that manual. By the way, why is this happening when our literacy rates and our math rates, why can't they just work on that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, but No, I agree. And I want to get to that. But what do you say? What do parents say if the answer is no? And what do you say if we're the experts? You know, let's that credentialed class talk, right? Mm-hmm. We're the expert. We know it's best. Like, no, we don't allow. For instance, I still have a request out to my local because I pay property taxes, even though my kids are not in the public schools because they're I'll save that for another show. But you have to. They're doing some new math curriculum. I want to see it. I want to see what they're doing. You have to go there and sit down in a room and have them bring to you. I mean, let's talk about a public school system who constantly says they care about vulnerable populations, right? What about the lady who works, you know, in a job where she doesn't get any time off or can't just go down and look at a school curriculum because she's in a job from, you know, 6 a.m. to 5 p.m. and then they're closed. So they supposedly care about this vulnerable population and yet make it so difficult to see these curriculums drives me crazy. But I'm already getting pushback. I've written twice. They haven't gotten back to me. So what is the answer when, you know, they say, or they just flat out say, no, you can't see it?
That would be hard to imagine. To be honest, I don't even know if that is legal for a school to like actually literally refuse. Though I can certainly understand what you're saying, that they might put so much red tape around it that it becomes extremely burdensome. You know, I obviously, like, you can start going to your school board meetings. There's also social media to do, you know, like a social media video at your school district saying, you know, hey, so-and-so school district, I'd really like to see the materials for such and such. I've been told I have to do it during school hours. I'm a working mom. I can't get there. Please, you know, I've asked and I'm trying to just see if there's others out there that are having the same problem. If you see this, you know, please retweet, reshare so that we can try to get it out and maybe get some support, you know, kind of use their own language. Like, I'm turning to the community for some, you know, grassroots, you know, support, as you said, for we marginalized parents, you know, that are working and would like to, you know, empower ourselves with this knowledge.
That's actually really smart. And I like the idea of using their language, but let's get back to the question of distractions in schools. And you kind of touched on this, you know, it's like, meanwhile, kids aren't reading, right? We're doing all this SEL stuff. And meanwhile, they can't read, you know, they have introduced a number of what I call non-RRR sort of reading, writing, arithmetic subjects into schools. And we've seen this for a long time, you know, decades now, where they're started integrating political narratives into schools. But I feel like in 2016, there were a lot of, and this happened in my school, there were suddenly walkouts. There were walkouts for teachers, and in my own school district, the entire, almost every teacher walked out. They actually had to officially close the schools because it was dangerous. They didn't have enough faculty in the schools. And that was all because of Trump. And then we started to see some gun walkouts. That was a really big thing. I can't remember the year, but it was a really big thing where lots of schools nationwide were, really encouraging the kids. I mean, it was all student run, but the schools were all in on it and wanted the kids to walk out.
Would the schools give the same support for a two-way support day?
Right.
You know, or a two-way walkout?
Or how about the day that in Washington, because we're right outside of Washington, how about when there's the big pro-life walk, right?
Yeah.
Would they encourage
no extra credit for that one?
Right. So then after George Floyd, we started to see the introduction actually in the curriculum. And again, you know, everybody's like, there's no CRT. No, it's woven then into. So it's like, if you have two racists over here and two racists over here, what does that equal? Like, I try to explain to people that it's actually woven into, and I saw this in my own child's, you know, literature classes, all the books, you know, he didn't read one book that was published before 1990. You know, it was all sort of modern literature, and it was always race and gender-based. And obviously we've seen the gender stuff, you know, introducing these concepts. And now we're seeing, gosh, there are even walkouts for the Middle East. Is this part of the mental health crisis that suddenly kids are so concerned, you know, climate change, the catastrophizing that comes with climate change? Is this does this account also for some of the mental health crisis that we're seeing in this country? Just the mere introduction of these really complex issues to kids that, I mean, my goodness, we're seeing this stuff in elementary school. Is that part of it?
I do. I think you touched on so many layers there, Julie, and I think that they're all important. But there are also somewhat distinct, I think, in the way that I view them as regards to our children. So, you know, you mentioned climate anxiety, right? So, yes, the simple fact of telling a child, you know, that the world is going to end in 10 years and all this other, you know, I believe nonsense. I mean, of course, that would give anybody anxiety, right? And they're not even saying, well, gee, then why do you think it is that some of the same people who say this are buying beachfront property? Why wouldn't they be putting all of their money into, you know, saving the, you know, not even asking
underground, you know, bunkers?
Yeah, any critical questions about that? But yeah, the simple fact of telling anyone that the world's going to end, you know, would obviously cause, you know, the children to have a great deal of anxiety. But then, as you mentioned, separately, when they're doing these, you know, extremely politically opinionated extra credit for activism and walkouts and whatnot, and it feels like if you voice a different opinion, and if you say, well, hey, you know what, in fact, my family voted for Trump, or in fact, you know, we are big supporters of the Second Amendment. What about the fact that, you know, good guys with guns can keep people safe sometimes? The children have what psychologists call, I believe they have what they call annihilation anxiety, which is the opposite of a safe space, where, you know, and I have felt it too as a student myself.
It's cancellation. You know,
I mean, but it's more than cancellation. It's annihilation. If you are you're a young child, you don't have a lot of social context or experience, you're not only going to be canceled socially, but you're also going to have your teacher suddenly start, you know, failing you. And you're going to be labeled, you know, as a bigot and, you know, as a hateful person. And I think that does cause a great deal of anxiety, because you have to then either pretend and kind of parrot the talking points that you don't believe in. It's almost like being in the witness protection program. I remember that myself in school. I had to laugh at political jokes I didn't think were funny, because I didn't want to be discovered. You know, I knew that, right. Literally, I knew I would never, you know, get my PhD in clinical psychology in Brooklyn. If I, you know, said the truth about what I felt about, you know, some of these issues. So I do think that kids have anxiety from a lot of this nonsense that is happening in the schools, and the nonsense that has nothing to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic, and that, in fact, of course, is taking away from learning time on those subjects.
You know, we've talked about the schools, we've talked a little bit about the medical community, we've talked about sort of suggesting these horrible things for kids and how that all contributes. And, you know, I also want to touch a little bit on social media and technology in general. You know, there's actually some great numbers. If you look at the data, in addition to the bad things, that, you know, goodness, kids aren't, there's, you know, teen pregnancy is down and sexual activity is down. And everyone's like, oh, that's so great. But then it's like kind of got this dark underbelly. Like, I'm super happy that teen pregnancy is down and that, you know, kids aren't drinking and they're not drunk driving and they're not doing drugs. And I love that. But the truth is, they're actually not socializing. Like, you can't get pregnant if you don't see someone, right? If you're literally not in the same room. Mm-hmm. And what we learn from these numbers is that kids, I mean, another example, kids aren't driving. They aren't getting their driver's license. They're not even interested. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of this they prefer low energy activities. And that also contributes. I mean, everybody knows if you doom scroll, you're going to be depressed. Like, it's not healthy. It's not. I catch myself doing it sometimes, and I'm like, get up. But I'm a full grown adult who has things to do, right? You think about a kid with fewer responsibilities, and actually, they get this sort of behavior is happening younger and younger now. But talk to me about where you weigh things. Do you think I'm kind of interested in, like, you know, I've mentioned a bunch of reasons why kids might be developing these mental health issues. How, you know, what weight do you give social media and sort of technology?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm like a less is more when it comes to screen time. And, you know, I relocated with my family to the free state of Florida when they tried to mask my son. That was like the only choice that we had. And, you know, Florida actually just recently banned social media, I believe, for kids under 13, something like that. And, you know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, what is the risks rewards analysis that would lead any parent? I mean, I'm sorry, like, people do things differently and everyone's got to do what is right for them, but I just don't personally understand what would be the risk reward analysis that would lead anyone to, you know, give their child access to social media. I think, you know, we all know, you know, where kids get exposed, you know, to predators. They get exposed to kind of warped body image issues. They get exposed to, you know, bizarre political stuff. I mean, anybody just check libs of TikTok if you're curious, like, you know, what is some of the stuff that could be exposed? And, you know, children are so vulnerable. And, you know, to your point as well, like, if you're, you know, doom scrolling, you not only have stuff to do, but you also have a fully developed sense of identity and boundaries and values and standards and a social support network that existed before you had a social media account. And I just think that we're making it much, much harder for kids to even be incentivized to get out and do those things. So again, for example, with my book, The Healthy Function of Anxiety is to Stimulate Preparation Behaviors, the healthy function of boredom is actually to go seek, you know, friendship, or to go seek, you know, some kind of stimulation. There is a healthy function to boredom. And I believe we're depriving children of that when we give them basically like Twinkies. It's like filling up on Twinkies when you're hungry. And it's like giving your child a big box of Twinkies. And I know some parents have said, well, you know, but my kids need that because the social events get organized that way. You know, Megyn Kelly, the podcaster, came up with an amazing solution for that. She said that she allowed her daughter then to create a Facebook account or whatever, but that it's on Megyn Kelly's phone. And that if there's an event getting organized or whatever, her daughter can do that through Facebook in front of Megan, so that it's really completely utilitarian and supervised. Like, I'm going to check, yes, I'm going to that event or whatever. But there's no need at all, in my opinion, for any child to be on social media.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm kind of with you. I just can't believe parents do, but I do allow. And if you do, you need to do it in a method like Megyn Kelly has done, where there's incredible supervision. I will say, you know, too, I feel like there's this culture out there of parenting is so hard. And also, I'm such a heroine for being a parent. Like, I'm like such an amazing person for doing like very basic things. And it drives me crazy because I don't like that, first of all, just in terms of, I think it discourages being a parent to other people who are not yet parents. Because parenting, yes, lots of things are difficult. Certain things that are difficult come with incredible rewards. Okay. When I do the laundry, I'm miserable when I'm actually doing laundry. Okay. I'm miserable. But then I have clean clothes in the house, right? Because it would be a bigger misery to live in a house with piles of dirty clothes. I just don't understand that. Yeah. It drives me crazy that people don't at least put it in perspective that yes, parenting is challenging. But there are great rewards. And I think it discourages, you know, I worry about that, discouraging women or discouraging people rather from having kids. Do you think that parenting culture and just, I guess, the conditions are going to get better? Or do you feel really, I don't think you want to be a grim person who's like, no, things are going to get, are getting worse. But there is, like, I feel like on the, for instance, and it's kind of hard to make a generalization of every issue, but like on the transgender issue, I feel like there's much more awareness of the dangers of this, you know, badly named gender affirming care. I think there's more awareness now. And I think there's less intimidation on the issue. But as far as, you know, kids and mental health, do you think things will get better? Do you think there's more awareness of the dangers of these things? Do you think there's more awareness of the dangers of SEL, the dangers of social media, the, you know, the problems with the public school system that seems to be ignoring parents? I always ask these because I feel like there's people like me and you who are hyper aware. And then there's, you know, this whole concept of normies who like aren't quite aware of the what a big problem this is. So I guess my question is, do you think it's reached the point where more people understand the problems and are taking steps to make it better?
Wow. Yeah, Julie, you with your multi-layered questions.
I know. I'm so sorry.
No, I need to apologize. No, I love it. It's great. No, I just, I'm writing down little notes so I can keep up with you because thank you. That's so much. So you started off talking about, you know, kids, you know, and parental vanity essentially, or like, you know, parental victimhood complex. Right. And I think you're right in many cases. And I think in some cases, that's actually why some parents feel so excited for their child to have a diagnosis, because, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I'm caring for my, you know, special needs child, and, you know, all, and it's almost like a parental vanity. And I agree with you that it's unfortunate for moms to do that, or, you know, dads, but I guess I can't help but also wonder if some of that is a reaction to our society not esteeming motherhood, to our society telling girls, ah, well, you know, you should have a real job, you know, and you don't have to be just a homemaker. I mean, again, for me, I went and got a PhD in clinical psychology, only to have a child in my late 30s. And then to, you know, I basically dialed down my work like 90%. I work about 10% of what I used to, because I'm so enamored of my newfound role. I get emotional talking about it as a wife and a mother. And I'm so thankful that I have, but I wish that our society would share that joy with women. And so I can't help but wonder if on some level, women feel like they have to fly the distress flag because our society is not just naturally recognizing and lifting them up enough. Now, two things can be true. Our society is not lifting them up enough, and then they're responding to it in a maladaptive way by saying like, oh, well, woe is me, right? Like the way to respond to it is to fly the flag and say, you know what? It's actually awesome. And, you know, when it comes to your second part of your question about like, you know, are we just the loners here, you know, or are there more like us, or is the word getting out? You know, I'm very excited by the internet, actually. For all the bad things I have to say about social media and the internet, I think it can be so incredible. It's connecting us. Like, you know, join your Moms for Liberty chapter out there. You know, I mean,
or your IW Network chapter,
or your IW Network. Thank you. All of them. Yes, you know, so that we can all band together. Because one of the things that the left actually has an advantage of psychologically, when you think about you know, very leftist mentality, you know, which in its extreme can go towards like socialism and communism, compared to, you know, say an independent or conservative mentality, which is more about individualism and individual rights and personal responsibility. One advantage that the left has on us is that by definition, their whole psychological makeup is about collectivism. They are incredible grassroots organizers. You know, they will, you know, be knocking on doors and, you know, hosting community picnics where they're, you know, secretly, you know, kind of, un, you know, not secretly, but, you know, in the background, you know, handing out the flyers and, you know, getting the early ballots, you know, collected and all that stuff. And, you know, just by, and this is not, again, just my own personal insight, this is a psychological known fact that they have a much more collectivist mentality, and that does help them in terms of politics. And so I do think that things are getting better for us on, you know, a more independent or conservative lean. But what we need to do to make that happen, to have a brighter future, is to make sure we don't just silo ourselves in our individual home, like, which is what a lot of us want to do. We just want to be left alone to live our lives independently. But we have to, as you said, join our IWF, you know, local chapter, our Moms for Liberty chapter. We have to get out there and band together and make our voices heard. And we have an incredible gift to do that, like never before, thanks to the internet.
It's such a great perspective. It really is. And I always do like to, I think it really is important. I'm very pro innovation. I'm very pro technology in many ways. You know, the medical advancements that have been made over the years are suddenly people are like, no, public health is terrible. And honestly, they did it to themselves, you know, with during COVID, public health really lied to us. And then the worst part, didn't show the humility and really have the honor to apologize for mistakes that were made. And the same is true in the medical profession. The same is true in the with psychiatrists, and not all of them. And also teachers, you know, the public school system still, you know, with the union still in charge. You know, it's amazing to me, I'm going off on one of my tangents, but, you know, it's amazing to me that I think it really, it deeply hurt me that I didn't see more pushback on what was happening in the schools, which we know was a result of the unions and federal agencies sort of collaborating and insisting on mask mandates and keeping schools closed. We know that the teachers' unions were involved in that. And to now know that nobody has apologized for that. These kids are suffering. And one thing I don't think you and I would ever deny or even need to talk about is the fact that the learning loss is real. And the learning loss is real because of the school shutdowns. And that contributes to anxiety and mental stress. And, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And I can't catch up. And so I think there's, you know, there's still anger, certainly from me. There's still anger on the part of a lot of parents. But they do want to help their kids. And you are an incredible messenger of sort of good news, because I think we are on the upswing. If you could tell people, if you could tell them about your book and where they can find your writing and where you are on social media.
Yeah, thank you so much, Julie. The book's website is nervousenergybook.com. That's nervousenergybook.com. And that will take you to my website where, you know, you can link through to find all my social medias. I love to be on social media. I'm, you know, have a YouTube channel and stuff. And if you do check the book out, it's also available Amazon, Walmart, anywhere books are sold. I would greatly appreciate any reviews, because as we all know with those algorithms, it really matters a lot. But also, I put there, I have drchloe.com/independent, which I know is a mouthful. So you can also go to makeachange.us and it will forward to drchloe.com/independent. And that is where I put, like, I told you I wrote these articles about like the harms of masking or the problem with the quote toxic masculinity issue. You can read where I kind of sound off on more of those topics as well. So thanks for having me. I love to be able to just, you know, join the fight with you. So thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. And I hope people all check out where your website and buy your book. And I have to tell you there throughout this, I mean, we've actually gone over the normal time, and you said about 30 things that I'm like, oh, I have to ask her to come back to expand on that. Let's talk about that. So I hope you'll come back soon.
Of course. I would love that. Thanks, Julie.
All right. Thanks for joining me. The Bespoke Parenting Podcast is a production of the Independent Women's Forum. You can send comments and questions to me at julie.gunlock@iwf.org. I would love it if you could hit the subscribe button and leave a comment or a review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Google Play, YouTube, or iwf.org. Thanks again for tuning in today.